From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
This is very simple. If the court rules on the law, term limits will be on the ballot. If they rule on the politics, well, then that's going to be a great tragedy for the voters of the state.
And it's because of a backroom process, an uneven, rushed process that has gotten to this point. And it's unfortunate, but it's okay because we have time now to produce the evidence to show that we're going to get on the ballot.
We're trying to follow the process that we outlined. You know, we're trying to be as fair as we possibly can be. I know that there's the allegations that we did a very sloppy job, and I understand that. That's what goes on. But we used the same process in both petitions.
And that was Rupert Borgsmiller. He's director of the State Board of Elections. Prior to him, Michael Kolitz, campaign manager for Yes for Independent Maps. And first, Mark Campbell. He's a lawyer for the Term Limits Initiative. Will those two citizens' initiatives to change the state constitution never make it to the ballot? Also, Illinois rolls back previous cuts to Medicaid and an Illinois congressman's bid to climb the Washington ladder. That and more on State Week. I'm Amanda Vinicky, filling in for host Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He's the director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS. With me at the State House, WUIS State House reporter Brian Mackey and Mike Riopel, political editor of the Daily Herald. Let's begin with those two separate efforts to change the state constitution, a term limits initiative, and also that would set limits for how long legislators can serve, and then also one that would no longer allow legislators to draw their own legislative districts. Those efforts coming up in two different ways this week. First, with the State Board of Elections and whether they have enough signatures to get on the ballot, and then a court challenge that is trying to prevent them from doing so, a hearing held this week. Brian, it seems like for either initiative to turn in over 500,000 signatures, that should be more than enough to make it on the ballot. But Yes for Independent Maps is coming into some trouble.
Right, because that's more than twice of what they think they would need, or about twice what they think they need. I think that number was 298,000. Don't quote me on that. But the idea with any petition you're doing, whether you're running for an office or trying to get a question on the ballot, is you need a lot more signatures than the minimum number because either people maybe weren't registered to vote at the address that the State Board of Elections has them at, or maybe the signature is just not legible. I've heard one of the so just to back up a step, I guess, the State Board of Elections takes these hundreds of thousands of petitions, and instead of checking them one by one, each single one, they do a random sample, and they develop this computer program with some professors at the University of Illinois Springfield. It's an algorithm that pulls out X number, an employee of the State Board of Elections will be sitting at a computer screen. All the documents have been scanned, these petitions, and they'll get an instruction, page 1684, line 6. And they'll go to that's a randomly generated code. They'll go to that page and they'll look at the signature and they'll look at the address and then they'll check that against the election database and see, is this person a registered voter at the address that, you know, they signed on the petition? Is that their voter registration address? Does their signature match? And there were just problems with different aspects of those. In some cases, I've heard that the Rauner petition, the term limits petition, they had people sign and print their names. The one that wants to take redistricting out of the hands of legislators, they just had people sign. So maybe it was a little harder to discern what the person's name was when they were checking it against the database. For whatever reason, that combination of factors, when they did this test, they found that the term limits petition did have enough valid signatures based on this statistical sample. And the preliminary results were that this independent maps group did not have enough signatures. And so they're out there now trying to do what's called rehabilitating, where they check voter registration files at the county level and with local election authorities and try and prove that, yes, the people who signed deserve to or properly so.
Well, because that can be all sorts of different facets, whether it's an illegible signature, whether a signature that is from somebody that's at a previous voting address.
Well, that's the thing. This is going on for months with these signing these petitions. If you move and then maybe updated your voter registration for the primary, now your official address in the Board of Elections is different than the one you were at when you signed it. Or maybe people just you know, didn't realize or something when they were doing it. This reminded me of when they do a census every 10 years. They always say, where did you live on April 24th? They pick a day and say, that is the day that we're going to base this on. That does not exist in this process. So over the course of months, you imagine some percentage of people move. And when we're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of signatures, that could add up over time. They also had a lot of duplicates. That was an issue. And that's one of the big things, talking to these professors who came up with this algorithm. One of the biggest things that they're trying to look out for is to say, you know, in our sample of 5% of the total that we're looking at here, how many are duplicates and what does that extrapolate to? So if we find, you know, John Smith signed 4 times in our small sample, does that mean that he really signed 200 times overall? And that's the kind of thing that they had to weigh here.
And the Board of Elections is trying to make the case that even though one amendment did pretty well with signatures gathering and the other one appears to come up short, that they use the same process to evaluate both, because the MAPS people have argued that the process was flawed and that's why they've come up short. And there was a lot of public pressure that led to the Board of Elections giving them more time to find evidence that maybe they had actually gotten enough signatures. People in the public and the public pressure saying that the people of Illinois should get to vote whether the MAPS process gets changed instead of having a bunch of lawyers decide that before the question ever makes it to the ballot.
And so I think, Mike, you're getting at some of these questions. It's the public pressure. And then as we heard from the leader of the Fair Maps Initiative, or so-called Fair Maps Initiative, I guess that's in the eye of the beholder, but Michael Collins calling it a backroom process and saying that it's really unfair. Charlie, can you give us just some history? Why is it so difficult in general to be able to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot in Illinois? It seems like, again, 500,000 signatures, even if you throw out half of them, that's a whole lot of work. It took many months. It took many thousands of dollars for both of these groups. And there are those who say, regardless, that they should be fairly presented to voters outside of the machinations and algorithms, that this is fair.
Well,
fair.
But that, it goes to, in my mind, it goes to the legitimacy of the process. At the Constitutional Convention in 1970, the issue of to what extent should citizens be allowed to make laws was brought up. And the general agreement among the delegates was, we don't want a California-type situation where basically interest groups will be writing laws and presenting them and having the kind of drawn-out battles that you see in California every election with these initiatives, this plethora of different ideas. And so they limited it very narrowly to the legislative article and to issues dealing with structure and procedure. And there's a standard that's in the law that says you have to have a certain percentage or petitions signed by citizens representing a certain percentage of the people who voted in the last election. And it occurs to me that for all the Fair Maps people whining and complaining about this backroom process, why is it that these alleged backroom deals didn't affect the term limits amendment? You know, Mike Madigan is perceived as being the Darth Vader behind everything in Illinois. And it occurs to me, if I'm Mike Madigan, I'm probably more interested in not having term limits rather than how we're going to do redistricting 7 years from now. And so, it occurs to me, where did these Fair Maps people get their signatures? How well did they vet the signatures once they were there? Did they double check them? You look at the Rauner operation. When I went to vote in the primary, there was a couple guys out there asking me, do I want to sign a petition for term limits? And so you figure that if you're getting people to sign as they go into the polling places, the chances of those signatures being valid are a lot higher than if you're doing it in the Walmart parking lot.
And just anecdotally, Charlie, to that point, I was asked, just walking around town, going to various events downtown here in Springfield, much more frequently I encountered the term limits people. And that is one of the things. Like I mentioned, the idea of the term limits people had people print their name as well as sign it. And so, and I know that the Browner people certainly brought in out-of-state circulators. There are companies that this is what they do. You can hire them to do your petitions. And I was looking at these forms at the Board of Elections. They, you know, and I know the one guy, he said it's a backroom process. I was invited in. I think anyone from the public could have gone and observed if they wanted to. And, you know, you could see that one of the circulators was from Nevada. So clearly they are, you know, it was a professionalized op. You know, they like to portray that this was all grassroots and volunteer, but they did pay a lot of people to circulate the petitions.
And of course, Rauner has the money to do that.
Yeah.
Outside of the signatures, though, it's not the only challenge both of these efforts are facing. Even before, actually, the redistricting initiative had been turned into the State Board of Elections, some legal paperwork had been filed. A court hearing was held in Chicago this week before Judge Mary Mikva, who will decide, do either of these initiatives meet some pretty strict requirements set forth, as you had talked about, Charlie, in the state constitution to be able to go before the ballot? What are those, Charlie? Can you explain what threshold do they have to meet there? And yeah, let's start with that.
Well, they have to deal with the structure and the procedure, and they're limited to that. When was it?
Because straight term limits back in the 80s.
Well, I was trying to remember. It was like 20 years ago when Pat Quinn was behind a term limits petition drive. They got enough signatures.
Funny
that, huh? Yeah. They got enough signatures, and the court threw it out saying that term limits exceeds this very narrow window. So to get around that limitation, Rauner's people tacked on a couple of extraneous points to the term limit portion. One would change. It would make it harder for lawmakers to override a governor's veto. That's the process part. And the other would change the size of the House and the Senate. That's the structure part. And this was an attempt to, I don't know, put lipstick on a pig, constitutionally speaking, so that term limits could slip by. I see the problem is that the language in the Constitution says that these amendments shall be limited to these two issues. It doesn't say that these two issues have to be tacked on to whatever else you want to do. So I think that the term limits there could well be a fatal flaw in that whole attempt.
Well, and it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned that Speaker Madigan may not care about the redistricting, but these term limits wouldn't even take effect. The clock would start in 2015, and then you would have 8 years. So the earliest anyone would be term limited out of the state legislature would be, what, 2023?
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capital by public radio station WUIS.
In terms of its constitutional powers,
Illinois Public Radio.
Because they can do line item vetoes on budget matters and amendatory vetoes and things like that.
Because of the amendatory veto, which in essence allows the governor to make law, and because of the appointment power and because of the ability to reorganize state government subject to a veto from the General Assembly.
Well, and getting to it's more than just the Constitution. I mean, I think as we're looking at all of this, these are things that I'm not sure how much voters are paying attention to now, but we mentioned the name Michael Madigan, and his attorney is the one who is challenging this suit. So Michael Casper says that this has nothing to do with Speaker Madigan. Mike, Brian, do you buy that? And is there anything to make of this court challenge that it's more than just legal, that it's also political?
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard to separate the two. I mean, Casper does a lot of the work for Democrats when it comes to challenging petitions and those kinds of election challenges. So I think it's reasonable for people who are watching this to go ahead and connect the two. Beyond the Constitution, like you guys have brought up, there would be huge political ramifications to either of these two amendments. The way the maps are drawn is about the most political process there is every 10 years. And then, as Brian brought up, those additional measures on top of the term limits part of the amendment would have major effects on how things work around here that we're probably not exactly sure how and why, you know, how it would affect things going forward. But think about how many close votes there are on vetoes and different measures like that. I mean,
how much we talk about supermajorities and how big a deal it's become that, I mean, it would be almost impossible to demographically to get supermajorities if you had to have a 2/3, I think, or at least it'd be certainly another big hurdle to try and get supermajorities in that case.
So good or bad, I mean, the term limits amendment politically goes way, like you've brought up, goes way beyond term limits and will have huge political implications. I think it would be silly to say there's nothing political about either the challenges to them or the plan to put them on the ballot in the first place.
Well, we will see if they ever get to that point. No timeline for a decision from Judge Mikva. This is State Week coming up. Chicago is lifted from a patronage decree. That and more.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Mike Riopel. I'm Amanda Vinicky. Briefly, let's discuss the governor did sign into law this week some changes to Illinois' Medicaid program after some changes 2 years back that were supposed to save a whole lot of money. Now, reinstating programs that would pay for patients' dental care and podiatry. Brian, can you speak to why Illinois suddenly has the money to reverse that decision and why Republicans are making such a fuss?
Yeah, well, this was a big deal a couple of years ago. They voted to say they're touting $2 billion in cuts to the Medicaid program. Medicaid, of course, is Illinois' program of health care for the elderly, poor, and disabled. And some of the things they cut, though, they've looked at it and said, this is costing us, this is at least Democrats, and even I think a few Republicans say this is costing us money in the long run. You have Medicaid coverage for adult dental services is one. In the changes a couple of years ago, they said that only emergencies would be covered for adult dental care. Well, they're finding that people will wait until, you know, they have a huge abscess, and then that can lead to blood diseases, and then they show up in the emergency room, and it costs how many thousands of dollars to the state for a Medicaid emergency room visit, whereas if you had just paid for them to go to the routine dental visit, that could have just been a couple of $100. So their argument is this makes financial sense. And there's things like that that go down the line with podiatry services and some other ones. I don't remember all of them off the top of my head. But that is why they're saying that a lot of these changes need to be made, that it's actually, you know, some people will say this is the more humane thing to do, that, you know, you're treating, giving people the dignity of how. I remember somebody mentioned on the House floor, how can you get a job if you go in and you have, you know, you go into a job interview and your teeth are all messed up or you have a lot of missing teeth, that can actually affect your ability to get a job. So that's one of the humanistic arguments, but there is also that financial argument that it actually makes sense to treat some of these things earlier instead of just waiting until they get to the emergency level.
And Republicans seeming to say that, you know, there may be some truth to that, but this comes on top of Illinois expanding who is eligible for Medicaid, because under the Affordable Care Act, Illinois is currently getting reimbursed from the state in terms that the Quinn administration is delaying rolling out managed care, that the Quinn administration is delaying or had delayed on attempts to go over who actually is receiving this government help and who, if the people are deserving of it. And that's leading to really long waits for processing who should be on Medicaid, getting into the doctor, all of that.
And there is a general criticism, and this relates to the Affordable Care Act, which is popularly known as Obamacare. One of the things that Illinois did do that, this is one of the things that the Supreme Court said states don't have to do. Illinois, being a very blue state, chose to expand Medicaid coverage to childless adults, they call it, people who don't maybe have kids, previously had not been eligible for government health care, and now they are eligible. And Republicans certainly have raised quite a lot of questions about that. But on this particular question of the restoring the adult dental and things like that, I think it's worth noting that 13 Republicans did vote yes when that came up in the House, including some who are going for higher office. We had Representative Cross, who's running for treasurer, voted yes, and Representative Sanger and Bost, who are both running for Congress, also voted yes. So this seems to be something that cut a bit across party lines.
Speaking of Republicans in Congress, we had U.S. Congressman Peter Roskam, who had previously served in the State House here, make a bid for the U.S. Majority Whip position after, of course, Virginia Congressman Eric Cantor in a surprise loss there. Spoiler alert, he didn't make it. What happened there, Mike?
Well, he was trying to move up. He's the chief deputy now, the number four Republican, was trying to move up to number three because Cantor was stepping down from his leadership post. He ended up not making it, like you said. One of the easiest, you know, speculations as to why that is easiest to understand, because there is no vote count. We'll never know exactly how
it's a secret ballot.
Yeah, we'll never know exactly how it happened. But one thing that came up is conservatives wanted a red stater in the House leadership. John Boehner from Ohio, the House Speaker, is from a blue to purple kind of state. Kevin McCarthy, who became the new whip, is from California, which is blue like Illinois. Peter Roskam, trying to become number three, is also from a blue state in Illinois. And, you know, that could have hampered his chances, especially because Eric Cantor was just beat a week ago in a race that a lot of conservatives saw as emboldening to them. So if Roskam is already going to have problems with conservatives, then the Cantor thing happened. That was even a bigger problem for him. I mean, from all accounts, it maybe was kind of a close race, and Roskam even promised to have a red state deputy if he won, but it didn't end up working out for him. And now Aaron Schock, who had worked on Steve Scalise's behalf, who didn't win the whip job, there it's possible that he could be appointed to the job Roskam has now.
So, Mike, does this have any broader ramifications than obviously plenty to watch in terms of Congress and this continued fight between the more conservative faction and more moderate factions of the Republicans? But how about for Illinois? Illinois' congressional delegation, you brought up Congressman Schock's future. How about Peter Roskam's? Any outcomes to be watching?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, Illinois, in a bipartisan way, it's always nice to have people in power in Congress. That helps you in a number of ways. For Roskam in particular, you know, it's not like he leaves Congress or anything and won't be a major member of Congress. He's still on the Ways and Means Committee. He's still on the Benghazi Committee that's going to be starting its work. So, but where he ends up in the overall ladder, you know, it's probably going to be another year or two before he gets another shot at leadership post.
And before we move on to other topics, let's stay with state Republicans here. The death after our last taping of the show of Jack Roser, who is a name I think probably a lot of Republican insiders know, because he over the years had tried to expend a lot of influence and dollars, to be frank, on the future of the GOP in Illinois. Mike, Brian, Charlie, whoever, I think we've all encountered Jack Roser, or again, at least his influence.
Well, I can just give a little bit of background quickly. This is a man who became very wealthy from a company that he founded called Otto Engineering. It makes radio components for police and military use, among other things. He was based in the suburbs of Chicago, and he spent millions of his dollars giving to conservative candidates and causes. But he spent a lot of that time not on the inside of the party, but kind of outside fighting to get in and get more of his people in. He ran for governor against Jim Edgar in 94 and then tried to defeat, you know, Mark Kirk in 2010 when he was running for Senate, for example. And he lost in both those cases and a lot of his other cases. But lately, it seems like when the the Tea Party became a thing in the country. It's sort of like the Republican Party moved more to where his views were. So, right, he was always the more conservative outsider fighting the what he viewed as the moderates in the Republican Party in Illinois. But lately he's had more success. He decided to support Bruce Rauner in the primary. You know, obviously Bruce Rauner won. So it remains to be seen what will happen next.
Mm-hmm. Moving on there, let's talk about something else that has exerted influence over Illinois politics for quite some time, at least in Chicago. That is what's known as the Shachmann Decree. This was supposed to try and ensure that the city was not giving jobs to insiders, cut down on patronage, and it seems as if Chicago has met that goal. That may sound, I think, surprising to a lot of people who follow politics. The Shachmann Decree lifted from the city. This is even as the man for whom the decree is named after, the attorney, has brought a case or against the state of Illinois for some hiring questions at the Illinois Department of Transportation and the Quinn administration. This week, it coming out, for example, that the stepdaughter of the director of IDOT had, out of nowhere, she doesn't seem to know how she got a great promotion, but lo and behold, paperwork appeared on her desk and she did. The IDOT director saying she knows nothing of that. So, Charlie, can you give some brief history about the Shachmann Decree, and then what does it mean for both the city and the state that it has been lifted and the weight of patronage here?
Well, historically, the Cook County Democratic machine was synonymous with county government and city government in Chicago. And if you lived in Chicago and you wanted to, you know, to have a tree cut down, or you wanted to have the pothole fixed in front of your house, you called your ward committeeman, and it got taken care of. And all that was required of you was that you vote Democratic twice in even-numbered years. And Michael Shachmann, who was a young attorney back in the early 70s, challenged that in court and got a decree that ultimately led to a kind of a hiring overseer, a monitor, to look over what the city was doing to make sure there was no patronage involved or to try and limit the amount of patronage that was involved. And so the over the course of time, the situation has changed and it's not as overt anymore. And so the federal court agreed, and Mr. Shachmann agreed, that the decree could be lifted, and as a result, it's going to save the city, I forget what the number was, it's upwards of $100,000 paying the cost of this court monitor to oversee all the hiring. On the state level, the Rutan decision towards the end of Jim Thompson's tenure as governor was supposed to preclude hiring, promotions, firing, based on political connections. And as we've seen, it's been kind of observed, but not observed. Certain positions are supposed to be exempt, policymaking positions, advisory positions. The difficulty is that the Blagojevich administration in particular expanded what counted as an advisory position much beyond what it should have been. And that's what the current beef is.
And that is all the time that we have this week on State Week in Review. We'd like to end the program extending our condolences to Illinois Senate Minority Leader Christine Rodonio on the sudden passing of her 31-year-old daughter, Lisa, who had been a staffer to U.S. Senator Mark Kirk. Thanks so much to our guest this week, the Daily Herald's Mike Riopel. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org or find it on iTunes by searching for State Week in Review. The production assistance for our program today was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capital by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.